I knew no one in my life who had ever made a dollar for themselves.
Me too.
You know what people are fascinated by? Power.
Yeah.
Power. Who's powerful? Who's influential? Who's got the juice?
Today we talked to a guy named Cliff Sims, a guy that grew up as a pastor's kid in Mississippi, grew up playing sports, but then how a middle-class guy went from being involved in a lot of violence growing up to working in the White House next to President Trump, then also wrote a New York Times best-selling book, and also got another one that's out now that you got to go look at. This story is crazy. We talk politics, we talk sports, we talk kids, we talk all of these things from one of the best human beings you'll meet and a gregarious personality that has stories about the president's nuclear football, to the doomsday room and the White House, to the CIA and all the different agencies. It's a fascinating call and talk with Cliff Sims. Cliff, thanks so much for joining me. Cliff, friend of mine, met through a mutual friend, BJ Ellis, and so excited to have you here with us. You've written two books, okay? One of the ones I want to talk about at length today is the new book, The Darkness Is Not Overcome. But the first book you written, Team of Vipers, was an Amazon bestseller, New York Times bestseller. It sold a bunch of copies about how you were in the White House with President Trump. So I want to get into those things. But before we dive into that, the thing that I like to do on here is just, who are you and where are you from? Like, what's the origin story of Cliff Sims?
Yeah. Well, who I am is a believer, and that's what defines me.
Right.
All these other professional things are cool. Mm-hmm. I love being a dad too. Yeah. I'm a dad, but like those aren't the things that define me. Ultimately, I'm defined by who God says I am, not who anybody else says I am, and He says that I'm His. So that's first and foremost above everything. But, other than that, I'm a kid who grew up with not a lot of means, but had two great parents. My dad was a minister and raised me in a godly household, but basically grew up in a neighborhood where we didn't have much. And for me, that meant being surrounded by people who were maybe not believers, certainly a friend group that was not particularly inclined to caring much about faith or what God had to say about anything. And, when I tell the story of my background, I usually point out that like we all have our issues, right?
Sure.
Like, so for some people it's alcohol, some people it's drugs, some people it's, you know, whatever it may be.
Right.
And for me, it was violence. That was really, I think, what I struggled with the most, and anger in my heart. Yeah. Yeah. First fight that I ever got in, I think I was probably 8 or 9 years old, and the lesbian prostitutes who lived next door, the two kids that live with them, were in the kitchen rolling up grass and pine straw in a paper napkin and trying to smoke it. And I thought this was stupid, and got an argument with them about that, and which ended up sparking a fight.
Nice.
in their kitchen. So, going all the way back to then, but even, throughout my teenage years and early 20s, I think that was a big part of this. Is just like an unexplainable anger, kind of frustration and chip on my shoulder that I had inside of me that I really wrestled with through much of my teenage years and in early 20s, and played basketball in college. One of the defining moments of my life was when I was playing at Delta State University in Mississippi.
You're from Mississippi, right?
High school,
growing up in Mississippi.
Jackson, Mississippi is where I was as a kid, and then in Florida for some of my teenage years.
Tell me about this. So in the culture here, where you live in Birmingham, just where I do, there's a lot of like stigma sometimes around being a preacher's kid.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So like they call them PKs here at Highlands, at Church of the Highlands. So tell me about that. Was there a stigma or an expectation there that you felt like was unmeetable? But tell me about being a preacher's kid.
I don't know if there was a stigma attached to it, but I think preacher's kids have a well-deserved reputation.
Yeah.
That seems to precede us all, and we've, a lot of us at least, earned that. Yeah. And I don't know why that is. It may just be as simple as human nature is to be a rebellious, have a rebellious spirit. And when you grow up in a household where you know, it all revolves around the church and yeah. faith and everything that maybe just a natural inclination to rebel mm-hmm. against those things.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't have a single negative thing to say about my parents. I mean, I think that's a lot of people as they're reading my book. I was talking to a guy the other day who had an advanced copy of it and was talking about how, you know, followed this story of your life in that time period. And it does seem to be filled with a lot of like, you know, anger and violence and all of these different things. And I was kept waiting for the part where it was going to say, and I was from a broken household and I didn't know my dad and it's actually the exact opposite. My parents are wonderful and still have a great relationship with them as an adult now. And so it's like, everybody looks for a cause and effect relationship and maybe there were other environmental things that did play a big part on me. I think friend groups I think that's one thing with my kid now, my son who's 6 years old, that I think about now so much about, I know how the people that I was around impacted my life and I want him to have good, you know, not just mentors, but like the friend group that you choose is going to make a huge difference in like the trajectory of that time period of your life. And so for me, maybe that had a lot more to do with it than it did my parents.
I think you're exactly right, because I think for me, for example, growing up, when I hit 15, critical, I've got a 15, a 12, and an 8-year-old right now. When I hit 15, a guy named Alan Drew and a guy named Jason Bowman didn't parent me, but they were as close to a parent, and they were only a year and 2 years older than I was. They picked me up, went to the Y to play basketball. Everything revolved around church.
Yeah.
Everything revolved around sports. So those two things were critical. So tell me this, play college basketball. Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me how sports kept you on the right path.
Well, I don't know if it did. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I think the friend groups that I had playing sports were the friend groups that were, you know, we were doing whatever it is that we were doing.
Exactly.
You know, but I do think, I mean, my son already very involved in sports as a six-year-old, and I think it's an important thing for a few reasons that I do actually still, maybe later in life, see the through line between sports and it. One of the most important things is the thing about being on a team is you get introduced to people from walks of life that you are not from and would otherwise not have an exposure to. And so the ability to talk to anyone from any background, to this day, I could talk to anybody,
absolutely,
anybody from a dope dealer to the CEO of a company and everybody in between. Yeah. And that really started with sports,
absolutely,
being around different type of people.
Yeah.
The other thing is, my life, at least early on, there was a struggle aspect to it from a financial standpoint, that because my family was a working class family that, you know, over time worked into the middle class. And now, you know, I make more money than I ever thought would be possible, but that's going to allow me in a positive way to give my son a better standard of living, quality of life, maybe than I had in some ways growing up. But sports has got to be the avenue by which there's some struggle in that. And when something's really hard, when you're struggling to master something, when you're having a hard time getting along with people, when you're having, you know, all of these different elements, that like sports is a great mechanism for there to be struggle introduced to a kid's life that might not otherwise be there. And that's one of the main reasons why I'm glad that my son is really, he's into sports already. And I see him struggle. I see him frustrated. I see him trying to get better. And that's the kind of stuff that'll play a role in your life forever.
So you and I grew up very similar in the fact that, now granted, my parents are divorced, but teachers, ministers, on the same socioeconomic playing field, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Pretty much. We grew up really similar in that way. I make more money now than my parents ever did. Just probably the same as you. Honest question. Do you worry about spoiling your kid?
Yeah, of course.
How do you guard against that? Besides prayer, how do you guard against spoiling your kid?
Well, I've found that the most likely ways I am to spoil my child are the ways in which I spoil myself.
Oh, that's good. Tell me there.
Well, because, you know, a lot of the things that, like, I don't want to do certain things anymore either. Like, I mean, let's take the TV and the tablet and the computer, for instance.
Okay.
The times when I would, quote unquote, spoil my son by giving him just like watch as much of this stuff as you want, sit here and do this, is because I don't feel like engaging with you right now.
Right.
I don't feel like
parenting
you
that's
right
it.
Now. And that's not me spoiling him. That's me spoiling me. Mm. So that's like I think about that all the time. Every human impulse I have, and that all of us have in a lot of ways, is for more comfort, an easier life. And that's, so I have to fight that fight inside of me before I can ever fight that fight for him.
That's so good.
So that's one. Sports, again, to come back to this, is like a big part of that, because it's built in struggle to get better at something. The other thing is, I notice that there are a lot of times where I could actually draw a direct parallel between parenting and when I was leading my company, in that there are a lot of things that are just a lot easier if I just do them. It's going to take me a lot less time if I just do this for you right now, employee or son. and really have to have the discipline to, you know, the old say, teach someone to fish rather than, you know, fishing for them. And so not automatically every time my son says help, helping, actually let him struggle a little bit and solve something on his own. And I've read a lot about this, and there are a couple of things that happen both physiologically and psychologically. Physiologically, there are neural pathways in the brain that when you struggle and overcome are connected, that if you have your child struggle, ask for help, fix problem for them, that those literal neural pathways do not connect anymore. And you do that over time, and you're hardwiring your child to not be able to have to struggle and to overcome. Mm. And then psychologically, imagine how little self-esteem you would have if every time you struggle with something, you handed it to somebody who helped you do that.
Sure.
And you never accomplished anything for yourself. Right. You never completed a difficult task. I mean, so much of our self-esteem is caught all up in the ability to overcome difficulty. And so just very practically on a day-to-day basis, son's having a hard time getting his shirt on. I'm not, you know what I'm saying?
That's
like,
so good. Yeah.
But instead of just going boop and then forcing him to, let's think about how we do this. Hold the shirt up. It's facing me. Okay, now I turn it around and I lay it down and I grab it by the bottom and I put one arm in and I put my other arm in and I pull it up over my head. So talking through that, and then the next time it's like, oh, we did it last time. Let's see if you can do it again. And then that helps him solve it himself. So like, that is not a fun, I don't enjoy teaching someone how to put their shirt on. You know what I'm saying? And every human impulse is like, we got to get out of the door. Give me that shirt. Boom.
Yes.
And so those are a couple of practical things that I think about.
They say this, whether it's your kid, whether it's an employee. So you've touched on the thing that I dealt with earlier when we owned Meal, Fit, and Table in Time, is teaching someone how to do something. And Sierra, who's over there behind the camera, she'll sit there and tell you the same thing. It takes, they say, this is the 15X rule. So if it takes me something 1 minute to do, it's going to take me 15 minutes to teach you how to do that thing. So it probably takes you 20 seconds to put that shirt on Shep.
Yeah.
So it's going to, in turn, whatever that multiplier is, 15 times longer for Shep to have it. But think about the time compounded over a long period of time.
Yeah.
Where you don't have to do that task anymore that Shep's going to now know.
Yeah.
And you've proverbially taught him how to fish. So the 15X rule is, it's hard to, because if something takes an hour, bro, 15 hours is a long time.
It's a long time.
So let's transition, because I love an athlete, okay? Talk to me about the basketball career, where that led you, and then go a little bit past the basketball career post-college and tell me where you went from there.
Well, the maybe single most defining moment of my life happened when I was playing basketball at Delta State University in Mississippi, and I decided that I wanted to transfer. Mm-hmm. And a buddy of mine was playing at Enterprise State Junior College down in South Alabama. My family was living in Florida at the time. And he's like, you know, I really think you ought to come and visit. I think you would actually like it. And like, you know, Google barely existed at the time, but I was like Googling it and, you know, seeing like, my gosh, it's got a monument to a bug in downtown, you know, the boll weevil monument
there. It's the first thing that pops up.
Yeah. It's like, man, I don't want to live in the bug town. But I was like, what? I'll come visit and check it out. Cause I wanted to go to a junior college play and then go back to another 4 year. Mm-hmm. And so I go and visit, and sure enough, I did like it. The team was good. They won the state championship that year. We did the next year too. And I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to transfer here. And so I had to call my parents to tell them I'm going to transfer, and call my dad. And, it was an unforgettable conversation, because he said, I was going to call you today and tell you that we're moving, our family is, to Enterprise, Alabama. And again, they were in Florida at the time. Neither one of us had ever heard of Enterprise, Alabama. This happened completely separate from one another, but my dad's best friend had become the senior pastor at a church in Enterprise and called him to come and be the executive pastor wow. at the church there. And so I remember that moment, because this was, as we were alluding to early in the conversation, a time in my life where I did not care what God's plan was for my life.
Yeah.
But even in that moment, he cared. He was ordering my steps and setting it up even when I didn't care.
Right.
And so that's how I ended up in Enterprise, and walked into Sunday school the first morning there. And the Sunday school teacher was a guy named Barry Moore. Mm. And immediately hit it off, because I had, you know, I had like this gold chain on or whatever, oh, yeah. ridiculous thing. And he goes, hey, man, I like your Mr. T starter kit.
So he's busting your balls.
Just right off the bat. I was like, okay, I like this guy. Yeah. And he's Congressman Barry Moore now. Mm. At the time, he was just a small business owner. And he was really the first person in my young adult life that I could point to and say, was like a mentor, someone yeah. that I aspired to be like him, because I saw the family he had
sure.
and the way he treated his wife and his kids. I saw his small business. He was always starting businesses, always investing. So he had, it's called Barry Moore Industries, BMI. It was a waste management company.
Okay.
So basically selling 20, 30, 40 yard roll-offs
yeah.
for construction sites, where they would bring the roll-off truck, back it up, put it down. Construction site uses it as their dumpster.
Get it.
They come get it, take it to the landfill. So he had a whole operation sure. around that. And he and I started doing some things together. Like he wanted to start a complementary business, a paper shredding document destruction okay. business. Kind of similar concept. You have a locked garbage can in your office, if you're a law firm or a doctor's office or whatever. Put your documents in there that need to be shredded. You're shredding so much, you can't just put it in an office shredder.
Take to them. Yeah.
We bring the truck there, roll it out, dump it in, shred the stuff for you, take it to the landfill, whatever. So I started, he and I kind of started a business that did that together. It was my first thing that I ever did
in
business. We were doing these little small kind of business things together, and I was learning without even really thinking. I wasn't like, oh, I want to be an entrepreneur. It's like,
right.
I just thought it was really cool. Mm-hmm. And also thought it was really cool that he controlled his own destiny to a sense. Like
yeah.
he didn't work for anybody else. And I'm not good at working for other people either. I mean, I worked.
Employable.
Yeah. Not quite, but dang near.
Dark
dang near, you know, I was able to work for the president of the United yeah. States. Like I subordinated my ego to say, I will work for the president of the United States.
I can do it.
But it was still hard. Exactly. I still wanted to be, you know what, Mr. President, maybe I should get behind the desk today.
This is what we need
to do. Let me do that. But I learned so much from him. And in 2010, I was still trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life.
Yeah.
I really didn't know. And he said, well, I'm about to run for the state legislature. It's like, I've never run for political office. I know you don't know anything about politics, which is true. I probably could have told you that Obama was the president.
Yeah.
But other than that,
that's about it.
I couldn't have told you who the governor was, couldn't have told you our congressman was, couldn't
yeah.
have told you who our U.S. senators were, couldn't have told you anything. And he said, I just think, you know, we've done these things together. We can figure this out together. Why don't you come work on my campaign and help run the campaign? And so he won and, you know, went on to become a U.S. congressman
wow.
after that. But that was the first thing that
I
ever did
in
politics.
What did you do? Like for him.
So one of the things, especially a state legislative race in a small scale like that, is it's so much door-to-door, so much. I created this idea. We're going to do what we call friends of friends events.
Okay.
So if I'm running for office and Thomas Cox is my friend, I will call Thomas and say, hey, would you host 20 of your friends at your house and I can come over to your house and like, let's just talk about the issues that they care about. They'll get to know me, friends of friends.
True grassroots
stuff. Wow. So I would organize those kind of events for him.
Kept him in homes all across Enterprise area.
Constantly.
Or whatever the area
yes,
was.
Yes, constantly. Awesome. Helped him, you know, create his ads. I helped write some of his ads and, just everything,
yeah,
soup
sure.
to nuts, running a campaign. Yeah. And I got to know the kind of premier political consultants in Alabama because they were involved in the race and the overall effort at the time. It's crazy to think about now. Democrats controlled Alabama. They had since Reconstruction for 136 years. And so 2010 was the year that Republicans took over the legislature for the first time since Reconstruction.
Wow.
So I met all of those people. Yeah. And 6 years later, I had an office in the West Wing.
Mm.
But, you know, a lot happened in between there,
yeah.
But that was the kind of impact that moment of moving to Enterprise, Alabama, completely separate from my family and being reunited with them there, combined with meeting Barry Moore and the impact he had on my life, that those are kind of the pivotal moments professionally,
right.
For sure.
So when we were kids, we played sports, we were involved in different things. You got asked this question a bunch, and you probably ask kids this question now. So when you were in high school, let's say middle school, high school, and somebody came up to you and said, hey, Cliff, what do you want to be when you grow up? What'd you say?
A basketball coach.
Did you?
Yeah, yeah. We all only know the universe that we've been exposed to.
No question.
I knew no one in my life who had ever made a dollar for themselves.
Me too.
Didn't know what people with money did with money because I didn't know anybody with money.
Yeah.
Didn't know what a small business owner, an entrepreneur, or an investor, or you name it.
Yeah.
That felt so unattainable to the point that I didn't think about it. It wasn't like I was sitting there like, woe is me. I wish I knew somebody who did. I didn't even know that I should think yeah. that way or that I might like that. Or so I knew basketball and, you know, I knocked the top off the ACT in reading and, you know, comprehension. I loved history even
okay.
then. So I thought I'll be a history teacher and a basketball coach.
Wow.
That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Even into college, that's what I assumed. I mean, when I was in college, I would go on the recruiting trips with the coach because for a couple of reasons. One, the coach knew that the parents would like me and that the kids would like me and be like, oh, okay, this seems like a cool,
this is the type of kid my kid's going to be around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He would like sitting there, if we'd go on a recruiting, be like, watch a game. We would talk strategy, talk X's and O's. So it had a multi-purpose for me. It's like, one, I'm tight with the coach.
Yeah.
I'm learning. I enjoy doing this. What else am I going to do? Sit in my apartment and play video games anyways. I might get well going the trip. So like, these are all things that like I did naturally. I was not strategizing to get ahead.
No.
It just, that was fun to me. And that's what I thought I would end up doing.
The path you were on.
Yeah.
So you're working with Barry doing these random businesses. And then you helped on a political campaign around 2010. Tell me about the business owner journey after that.
Yeah. Well, so I thought at that point, I've met all these people who are political consultants,
okay.
quote unquote, that run campaigns and, you know, all that. And I got bit by the political bug because it's got a lot of the competitive aspects of sports.
Oh.
Like there's a winner and there's a loser.
That's right.
Let's go get it.
Yes.
You know? And so like that was really, and I started like realizing that a lot of the values that I had that my parents instilled of me manifested themselves in the political sphere. And like, so it felt like a fight for something that like, hey, let's get these ideas. It was about ideas.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that aspect of it as well. And so I thought I was going to be a political consultant.
Okay.
And so this was 2012 now, 2011, 2012. And political blogs were all the rage around the country.
Okay.
This was the rise of BuzzFeed.
Yep.
This was the rise of... Breitbart was huge, Daily Caller on the national level. All of the major media companies were still trying to figure out digital media because it collapsed their business model in a lot of ways. And to this day, they're still trying to figure out how to make that shift completely. Cable companies going through it now. But at the time in Alabama, the only ball game in town was AL.com.
Yep.
and which was the online hub for the Birmingham News, Huntsville Times, and Mobile Press Register, all kind of under one roof. And it was terrible. And so I thought to myself, here's what I'll do. I'm going to start a blog. I know all the inside players now. Mm-hmm. I know the governor. I know the Speaker of the House. I know all these people that I met that are in power now. I'm going to have access to insider information there.
Right.
I will write about my views on those things on my website. Then people will want to hire me as a political consultant because I know what's going on. Right. I'm on the inside. And what instead happened was it exploded and millions of people were reading it. Literally millions of people were reading this Alabama political blog.
Zero financing.
No financing.
It's probably a WordPress website.
It was, yeah.
WordPress website that you're just writing your opinion because you know some people. You're writing, yep. Again, we'll go talk about this later. All gets back to relationships.
Yeah.
You're writing these things and people just started, it just started catching fire.
Yes. I thought it was a biz dev opportunity and it became the biz, you know, instead of the biz dev. And so I realized, hey, we could flip a switch and make this from a blog to like, let's do a full blown news outlet now. And so that's what it was called, Yellowhammer Politics. Right. Yellowhammer is the state bird of Alabama. Mm-hmm. And Yellowhammer Politics became Yellowhammer News. And so then we had a radio network mm-hmm. to go with it, with the online hub. And we started doing, and I was figuring out the business model. And one of the things that I realized was you've got impressions. Everybody's selling impressions. It's a loser, total loser. But you got to do it to some degree. You take the money if people want to do that.
Right.
But having a multifaceted, multi-income stream plan was the only way to go. So we have like the online hub, then we have a radio show. So imagine write an article. Now I'm on the radio and I'm talking about that same article. And I'm able to tell advertising on the radio. Mm. And then every single radio station, you have to take breaks. So selling ads on those. But then also at the top and bottom of the hour, people don't realize this. A lot of times it's not the radio show's space. It'll be like you'll hear the weather, for instance, or you'll hear the traffic, for instance. Those are actually paid slots.
Didn't know that.
So it's the traffic brought to you by Thomas Cox Podcast. Yeah. You know, whatever it may be. And so I actually started a statewide network that sold those blocks of time in stations all over the state. And so, for instance, top and bottom of the hour news brought to you by whatever, and you know, by Yellowhammer. And so it would be like, here's the stories that you should care about today. So we could be on country radio, you could be on talk radio, you could be on oldies, yeah. You could be on whatever, top and bottom of the hour news. Wow. Brought to you by Yellowhammer News, sponsored by,
yes,
name a company.
Yeah.
So I had all these different revenue streams, and the other piece of it was sponsorship for events. What made the site blow up?
Sponsorship for events.
This will tie in with even my later like professional career in the book that I've written as well. You know what people are fascinated by? Power.
Yeah.
Power. Who's powerful? Who's influential? Who's got the juice?
Yeah.
That's in your office.
Yeah.
Their inner office dynamics. That's in like national politics. Yep. That's in every possible way. Everybody's fascinated by power. So I did this list on the Yellowhammer website called the Power and Influence 40, the 40 most powerful and influential people in Alabama mm-hmm. politics. And I ranked them. There were elected officials on there. There were lobbyists on there. There were CEOs on there. And it took people behind the curtain wow. of what was going on. So this spread like virally all throughout the state. And then I did an event called the Power of Service event. And it was all about these 40 most powerful and influential people, but the way that's the giving back and serving the state. Yeah. And then, of course, if there are three executives at your company who are on the power and influence list, isn't your company going to spend $50,000 to sponsor that event to Absolutely. Make sure that everybody knows that, especially if you're a governmental affairs firm, a lobbying firm, wow. you know, a law firm,
yeah.
you know, so we're getting, now we have sponsorships for these events. So we're making big money, you know, doing these events and selling sponsorships for them. So it's all these kind of things. That was just like feeling yeah. my way through
it was all an experiment.
It was all an experiment.
Huge experiment yes. that ended up being really, really successful. So you're at Yellowhammer and that thing's rolling. Mm-hmm. It's going pretty good. Where do you transition from there?
Well, I got to know as a part of that of running Yellowhammer. I was like I was the CEO of it, but I was also the main journalist. I was the one writing. I mean, that time in my life, my wife and I look back on it now, it's like, how in the world, man? Yeah. Because I would write stories all day. My goal was to write 8 stories a day. Me.
8?
Me, by myself. I had other writers, had other people, but I was going to do 8 stories a day because that was the only way I could compete. Is like, if you're coming to my site multiple times a day, or at least in the morning to see what's new, there better be some new stuff there. So I'd write all day, take only breaks for meals and to do my radio show. My wife would go to bed at night and I would sit there and I would write till 2 or 3 in the morning.
Really?
And then, cause I had a morning newsletter, sell sponsorships in the morning newsletter that would go out in the email. Yep. And every morning, your morning newsletter would have 8 or 10 new stories a day that you could, you know, and we could show advertisers, the governor reads this email every day. The U.S. senators read this email every day. The most powerful people in the state read it. And so they'll pay a premium to be able to advertise in front of those eyeballs. But it was all consuming. And the only day off I had was Saturday because I got to work in the afternoon on Sunday because we got a newsletter coming Monday morning.
So you'd take Saturday off.
So I would take off Saturday, and that was it.
How long did you do that? How long did you keep up that pace?
So that would have been 2011 or 2012. 2011, I think. 2011 until 2016. So about 5 years. I did that all day, every day. That's all I did. And then we had a few other milestones. I mean, I hate to use the terminology got the credit for, because it's not necessarily a good thing, but like, you know, I think a lot of people would say the downfall of our governor, who had to resign, was a result. We broke a lot of those stories.
Yeah.
That, you know, so we were, you know, got national and international recognition for Yellowhammer News as the one breaking all of these scandals down there, exposing corruption. And so I was getting burned out. I was definitely getting burned out by it. And I had become friends with Jeff Sessions, who was our U.S. Senator at the time. And Sessions was the first U.S. Senator to endorse this guy, Donald Trump, who came down this escalator in his New York Trump Tower and you know, burst onto the political scene. Yeah. And he said, you know, you may never have another chance to do this. You should really think about it. Take a leave of absence. Go join the campaign. You know, if he wins, then who knows what happens. But even if he doesn't, what an experience have that you otherwise wouldn't have. And Yellowhammer will be here when you get back. And so that's what I did. And then Trump won.
Wow.
And so that's how I ended up.
So he wins. So he's on the campaign. So while you're on the campaign with him, I hate to say the word buddies, but like, did you get to know him, or was it just like such a massive organization that like, no?
No, I mean, I got to know him really well. And part of the reason why is it was not a massive organization. Mm-hmm. It's like a small group of people on one floor of Trump Tower.
I remember, and I read that in your book.
Yeah, it was very few of us there. I mean, that's why, you know, it was hard for us to believe that we were going to win, because we have this gut feeling. Something's happening. Everywhere he goes, tens of thousands of people show up to these events. There's like an energy that is like unexplainable. And yet all the data says, the public data says we have no chance.
A true underdog and story in sports.
Big time.
Yeah. True underdog.
Yeah.
This team's bigger, faster, stronger.
Yes.
But there's something in our soul that says we can win this thing.
Yes. Hillary Clinton had... I can't remember the exact number, but I feel like it was a 10-to-1 staff advantage. Like her team was 10 times larger than Trump, something like that. It's just like, we're on there just a group of hooligans, just like flying by the seat of our pants. And so I did get to know him, you know, when he would shoot videos, ads or direct camera things or whatever. Like I was doing all those things. And really the only reason I started doing those is because they were like, oh, Cliff ran a media company.
He's got it.
Yeah, let Cliff do that. And so they knew I could write and they knew I could do. So that's how I got to know him, because he's a TV guy, right? So like, he cares how he looks on camera. He cares what he's saying, obviously, on camera. So like, the level of trust that we built, because like, I'm gonna take care of you. And I learned his idiosyncrasies. I loved which way he likes to get shot, from this side rather than that side. You know, he likes a certain color background behind him, because, you know, it makes his, if it's a And that's been so long since I did it. I can't remember now if it's either a black or white background. He felt like his hair looked too frizzy.
Yeah.
And he wanted it to look a certain way, wanted it to shoot from a certain side. He likes the lighting to be darker than most people like for it to mm-hmm. be on set. Like not around, I mean, like on camera. He likes the camera lights to be a little bit darker than most people do. All these little idiosyncrasies that made him. And he got to where he knew he could trust that, like, he doesn't have to play producer anymore because, like, Cliff's gonna take care of it. I don't have to worry about that anymore. And so when he came into the White House, that's how I got to know him. And then I continued to do that when I was in the White House with him as well. So, I got to know him very, very well.
So today we talked to Cliff Sims, and this episode was so good and had so much into it. We're breaking it up into two different episodes. The first part is where we talked to Cliff about how he grew up in a middle-class home as a pastor's kid, how basketball was a little bit of an outlet and it helped him get to college, and how he talked to his first mentor and now how that thrust him in the political world and working with President Trump. And then in the second part, we're going to talk about how his brand new book and how having the first book and how the publisher didn't want to take on the second book, but he's got a publisher that did take it on. And this is a fascinating book that takes the world of power in politics and intertwines it with what the Bible says about it. And so I can't wait to bring you both of these episodes with Cliff Sims.